Something for the weekend. Good morning, it's Trina Mara. I'm delighted to have Frank Graney on the line now. And Frank is an old pal of mine, an old colleague, and an unbelievably talented courts reporter, and now an author as well. Hard to believe, Frank, all those years ago, I think you were only just out of college, about to learn the trade, and now look at you doing brilliantly in your career.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say so, Trina, and thanks very much for having me on the show. It's lovely to talk to an old colleague and an old pal as well. Very nice to talk to you this morning.
The reason we have you on today is you've just written your first book, and I'm delighted to see this, called Crowded House, the definitive story behind the gruesome murder of Patricia O'Connor. Now, Frank, you are a courts reporter. Everyone will be familiar with your voice from being on the radio reporting every day, really. Why did you decide to cover this particular case in a book?
That's a very good question, Trina. I suppose, you know, through the nature of my work, I have covered some cases that I'm sure you and your listeners will be very familiar with down through the years. The Belfast rape trial, for example, the Graham Dwyer murder trial, and the Mr. Moonlight trial. You know, and I have been approached in the past to write stories on some of these cases, and I've turned opportunities down in the past. And the reason for that, I suppose, not that these cases weren't of interest to me, I just felt that there was nothing new that I could bring to the table, that it would have been just dredging up all of that horror for no greater purpose other than writing a book and selling books. And I know that kind of sounds ridiculous because that is, you know, obviously very important. But with this, I just saw the opportunity to do something for Patricia O'Connor, the victim, and her family, because, you know, without getting into the gruesome details of what happened to Patricia, and clearly I had to talk about those and write about those in the book, she met a very violent and horrendous death at the hands of a man called Kieran Green, her daughter's boyfriend, the father of three of Patricia's grandchildren. He bludgeoned her to death in the home they shared in Rathfarnham back in 2017. And after that, then he buried her in the shallow grave in Wexford. He then returned 10 days later. I am conscious of the time as well, Trina, and the gruesome details of the case. So I'll tread carefully, but the details are obviously, you know, very disturbing and very distressing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Kieran Green returned to that shallow grave. He dug her up. He dismembered her and he scattered her remains across the Dublin and Wicklow mountains. And what's more than that, you know, afterwards, in his attempt, I suppose, to cover up what he did, he told the most despicable lies about this woman. He portrayed her as a monster. He, you know, described her as a violent bully. He accused her of beating his children, her grandchildren, whom she absolutely adored. These lies were also spun by Louise, who found herself in the dock, Patricia's daughter, not accused of murder, but accused of and convicted of attempting to help Kieran Green get away with murder. She also wrote in on the lies that Kieran Green told. And I just remember from speaking to some of Patricia's brothers and sisters, her son Richard, during the trial process, you know, these people are salt of the earth. They, you know, came from Winegap in County Kilkenny. They were travelling up every day for the trial. And I just couldn't fathom how Patricia O'Connor had come from such a lovely background to be then depicted in court as this violent bully, this monster, mm-hmm. as I mentioned. And thankfully, through the conversations that I had with her family, I quickly learned that that wasn't the case, that this was essentially a web of lies that was being spun by some of the accused to help Kieran Green get away with what he did. And I suppose, tragically, the family felt they didn't get an opportunity to share, you know, the real Patricia O'Connor with people. And through the book, I felt that that was a platform that I was able to give to them, and I really hope that through Crowded House now, Patricia's voice is heard loud and clear.
The reason it's called Crowded House, Frank, is because they were all living in Patricia's house that she was paying the mortgage on, she was paying all the bills on, and there was her daughter was there, the boyfriend was there, and the three children, so five extra people in the house. And I guess Patricia, after a while, was thinking, maybe it's time you move and get your own home, you know. And that's probably where it all started. He didn't want to have to do that. He didn't want to have to move.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of the dynamics within that crowded house. Crowded House is a very appropriate title for the book. I don't think you could find two words to sum up better what was happening at Mountain View Park in Rathfarnham, a house, as you mentioned, correctly so, that Patricia O'Connor owned, and she was paying the mortgage on it. There were nine people living in there at the time that she was killed, three generations from the same family. Her daughter, her grandchildren, Kieran Green, was living there. So too was Patricia's husband, Gus. who is also serving a sentence for attempting to help Kieran Green get away with what he did. He went down to Rathfarnham Garda Station to report Patricia as a missing person at a time when he knew that she was in fact dead. And cruelly, he did that in the company of their son, Richard, who was totally unaware of what had happened. He became concerned about his mother's whereabouts and her welfare when she didn't contact him to wish him a happy birthday back in May of 2017. It was a busy house. It was a four-bedroom house, but there were 9 people living in it. There were dogs, cats, budgies. The prosecuting barrister, Roisin Lacey, when she opened her case to the men and women of the jury on the first day of the trial, she described the chaotic nature of it and the tensions within that house. And I think it was particularly so after Patricia retired. She had worked for 32 long years in Beaumont Hospital in the catering department there. She was well-loved by her colleagues. She made some very good friends there. And they spoke about the difficulties that she had towards the end of her time at Beaumont Hospital, the stress and the strain of the house. Her grandchildren were growing up. And it was just becoming a very cramped pressure cooker kind of a situation. Patricia was determined, I learned through conversations with her friends, she was determined after she retired at 60 years of age to sort the house out. She had plans for her retirement. She was a very keen gardener. She wanted to do up the house. She wanted to do up the garden at Mountain View Park. She even spoke about potentially selling it. She was very drawn to her homeland of Winegap in County Kilkenny. And she did have dreams of perhaps moving back there in her retirement and seeing out her years surrounded by her brothers and sisters in the countryside. She was determined to sort the house out. She was determined to get the likes of Louise and Kieran and her grandchildren out of the house, and not in a bad way. She felt that it was time now for Louise to move on. And Louise was offered a number of different houses by the city council. I recall she was offered a house in Dunleary, and she turned that down because she felt it was too far away from the kids' school. Louise, I learned, hated taking public transport, and that was also another factor as to why she turned down that house in Dunleary. You got the sense that Louise had no intention of leaving that house, that she felt that she was almost entitled to it. And you really had to feel for Patricia O'Connor going home after long days at the hospital. Louise, her daughter, didn't respect the house. She didn't tidy up after herself and her kids. Kieran Green was useless. Gus didn't get involved. So then for her to retire and to be around the house, you know, obviously more than she would have been in the past, it must have been very difficult for her to see that day in, day out, and particularly when Louise seemed to have no intention of leaving.
No. Frank, was this the story, just to remind people as well, was this the one where they were pulling out the bins dressed as Patricia to make it look like she was alive?
Yes, the allegation that was levelled against Stephanie, her Patricia's granddaughter, Louise's daughter, who also lived in the house, was that she and her mother Louise essentially came up with this plan whereby Stephanie would dress up as her grandmother and leave the house at a certain point after Patricia O'Connor had been killed. And that was for the benefit of a camera, a CCTV camera that was mounted to the front of a neighbour's house. Now, this camera was on the neighbour's house, but it did take in a certain section of the front of Patricia's house. So the plan that they came up with, this so-called ruse, as it was described in court, was to tell Gardaí that there was a big row in the house and that Patricia had simply left. Now, obviously, Kieran Green had killed her. And I suppose to support this ruse, they decided that Stephanie would leave dressed as her grandmother. But what they didn't account for, and I suspect this would have featured heavily in the jury's deliberations when they eventually went out to consider all of the evidence, what they didn't account for was a camera that was mounted to the rear of their neighbour's house. Whether they knew about that camera or not is insignificant, but they certainly didn't know that it reached into their back garden. So what the jury was able to see at one point was conversations being had in the back garden around the time that the prosecution claimed that Patricia O'Connor was dead and in the house. And then you see this figure leaving the house, and it couldn't be identified as Stephanie in the footage, but it's fair to say at this point the jury believed that it was her. And crucially, it showed Stephanie coming back a short time later with a piece of luggage, a suitcase in her hands that this figure was seen leaving with. So they were able to put the pieces of the puzzle together, and they believed that Stephanie had left. And that was all part of this ruse to make it look like Patricia O'Connor was still alive at a time when they knew, in fact, that she was dead and that Kieran Green was responsible.
God, sometimes it's like watching a TV show, and I'm sure you feel that way sometimes when you're covering these cases in court, Frank. You know, when it's such a gruesome case like this, and you've covered the Anna Creagel trial, all these very gruesome ones, and juries often can't cope at the end, and they get signed off that they never ever have to do jury duty again. Do you get affected? Because this is your 9 to 5, and you're doing this day in, day out.
Wow, that's a good one. I suppose, yeah, look, you know, back in the newsroom, they call me old Blackheart because, you know, I can sit through these cases relatively unaffected. But I don't think that's a fair assessment. I mean, you know, you are dealing with the most dreadful of stories and the most dreadful human tragedy. And it's always surprising to see the level of violence, you know, that one human being can and has the potential to inflict on another. But I think I am very good at detaching, you know, my personal life from my professional life. And I think that if you're to carry around all that horror with you, you know, it's certainly not the right job to be in. These are dreadful, dreadful cases, and you do try and look for silver linings. And I know that might seem like a daft thing to say, but it must be very rewarding and comforting for a family whose loved one has been taken in such violent circumstances. But for them to at least get justice, I think that does help with the healing process. You know, you look at, you mentioned Anna, you look at her parents, Geraldine Patrick, who, you know, they've also been handed life sentences, and they certainly won't be getting parole from them. Anna won't be returned to them, and all they're left with is memories. But they do have the comfort of knowing that the people that were responsible for doing that to her are behind bars. You know, they have opportunities to tell the world about their loved one. And it was the same with this case, and that was the whole point behind the book, was that, you know, more often than not, juries aren't concerned with who a victim was, what kind of life they led, what their dreams were for the rest of their lives, you know. And through Crowded House and through my work, and that's one of the most satisfying things about it, and one of the reasons I suppose that I feel like I can cover these cases, is because you are serving that purpose. You're giving them that platform whereby they can talk about their loved ones. And I know from talking to victims' families down through the years, that is very important for them. I recall one case that I covered, one of the very first cases that I covered in the courts back in Galway as a freelance journalist. Work was thin on the ground, and I remember the Central Criminal Court while sitting in Galway at one point, and there was a rape trial going on, and there was a young woman who had accused her stepfather of abusing her as a child. Her mother had stood by her stepfather. She didn't believe her own daughter for years. She wouldn't believe what she was saying. She stood by her man. And this man was ultimately convicted. And I'd covered this case day in, day out. It was getting a lot of attention locally and nationally. And as a freelancer, you know, that was obviously very good news for me. And this man was convicted. And I remember this young woman got up and she delivered her victim impact statement. And it was absolutely incredible. She was outlining in, you know, such powerful and emotional terms how the crime had affected her, and she felt that this man had not only stolen her childhood from her, but he'd also stolen her future, and he had stolen her mother. Her mother still stood by him, still supports him, didn't believe her. I jotted down this victim impact statement. I ran out of that courtroom and I was tapping frantically away on my laptop, and I knew that this was going to get an awful lot of attention. And I just noticed in the corner of my eye this young woman who had just delivered her victim impact statement in the corner of the hall outside the courtroom, bawling her eyes out. She was, you know, inconsolable, incredibly upset, and she had nobody there to support her. You know, her mother clearly wasn't there to put an arm around her. And I closed my laptop. I went home. I just felt at that moment in time that wasn't for me. That, you know, here was I benefiting on the back of somebody else's traumatic experience. And I remember getting calls from local stations and national stations looking for the story, and I didn't file it. And to this day, that's one of my biggest regrets, because I've since learned through covering these cases, these difficult cases, that woman wanted her story told. She wanted this man named and shamed, and she wanted to tell the world her story, and I didn't give her that platform. And I'm always conscious of that, and I suppose, to answer your question, that's what gets me through the day job. It's that kind of feeling that there is a greater purpose than just reporting on these dreadful things.
Yeah. Obviously, Frank, you're a great talker, but to do the job that you do, you have to be an absolutely brilliant listener as well, because the detail is so important. The rules regarding court reporting, do they scare you sometimes in case you ever get it wrong?
Absolutely, all of the time. And I think that's a really good thing, because it is the type of job where if you do get too comfortable in it, or if you do let your guard down for a second, it can have catastrophic consequences. You know, it differs from general reporting in that sense. You know, if you get something wrong during a trial, you could bring down that trial. You know, you could get yourself in trouble. You could be held in contempt of court. Trials have collapsed in the past because of media coverage. Thankfully, I haven't found myself in front of a judge in those situations, but I can see how easily it can happen. And you are constantly walking that tightrope. And when you're discussing a live trial, you have to be very careful about what you say. You know, there are certain things that you simply can't say. Like, while a trial is live, your report, it just needs to be a fair and accurate, balanced summation of the day's proceedings without any emotion or opinion injected into it, regardless of the circumstance of the case. So reported during the trial can seem quite cold and clinical, but there's a reason for that, because obviously there's somebody in the dock who has a presumption of innocence, and you have to be very careful not to prejudice them. You have to be very careful to give them a fair trial. So you are kind of constantly walking that tightrope, and I often feel, particularly when there's a high profile trial and, you know, you're doing live pieces into various shows, there's the potential to be asked anything. So you have to always be alert and always be on your guard. And you do have lawyers that are specifically assigned to monitor the media coverage. Defense teams will assign lawyers to do just that. And I'm reminded of a moment during the Belfast rape trial whereby I was getting the lift up to the fourth floor at Laganside Courthouse in Belfast, where that now infamous trial was being held for a number of months. And I stepped into the lift, and just before the doors closed, Stuart Olding's barrister, Frank O'Donoghue, stepped in. It was just the two of us climbing to the fourth floor at Laganside. And he turned around and he knew me, and he said that he'd been following my work. And he asked me, he said, do you know what my wife and I do every night when we get into bed? And I was thinking, you know, Mr. O'Donoghue, I don't know if I want to know what yourself and your wife get up to every night when we go into bed. But he said that the last thing he does at night is, he and his wife, they used to go through my Twitter feed because I'd been live tweeting during the trial, and he was monitoring what I was reporting on that particular platform. And I just remember saying to him, you know, I don't know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And he said, oh, it's a good thing for now. And what Mr. O'Donoghue was telling me in the kindest way possible was he was marking my card. I hadn't put a foot wrong at that point, but he was letting me know in his own little way that it was being monitored, and rightly so, because, you know, whoever is accused of a crime is entitled to that presumption of innocence. And if something that myself or any of my colleagues say could influence the jury in any way, then it should be called up upon. There is a very high standard when it comes to this particular type of reportage, and there before the grace of God go I, thankfully, I haven't found myself on the wrong side of the law in that sense yet.
Frank, do you get a gut feeling though what the verdict will be fairly early on? Do you kind of get a sense of how it's going?
You do. I do try and approach all of these cases with, you know, a very open mind. You'll hear a lot of things being said before a trial starts. You'll hear the rumour mill is always in full flow before a trial begins. Often from the moment a person is brought before a court, you'll hear all sorts of things. And to be honest, I try and ignore all of that nonsense, because until a case is put before a jury, that's all it is. And all the jury is ever concerned with clearly is the evidence and the facts of the case. And I do try and sit there almost as a juror with an open mind. But clearly you're a human being with opinions. And as a trial develops and as evidence is being presented and as it's being tested before a jury, clearly you will make your own conclusions. And, you know, a jury will go out to begin its deliberations, and there will often be conversations in the media room, you know, amongst myself and my colleagues about what way we think the jury is going to go. And, you know, you'd be surprised how many times, you know, you're not on the same page as the jury. And such is the sanctity, I suppose, of the jury room. You're never privy to those conversations. You don't know how a jury arrives at his decision. But equally, there have been cases where it's almost like a coin toss, that by the time you've heard all of the evidence, just like the men and women of the jury, it's often too hard to call. Cases where evidence is purely circumstantial, for example, where there's no smoking gun, so to speak, or no forensic evidence, they're always very, very difficult cases to prosecute. And it takes a very thorough investigation and a very skilled barrister to get those cases across the line. So to answer your question, I suppose at the outset of a trial, I do try and approach it with a clear mind and an open mind, and to treat it almost like a juror. But clearly, you have to be very, very, very careful when you're reporting your case, that you don't let your opinions bleed into your reportage.
And Frank, when somebody works in news, we know that, you know, it can be very hard to have a normal personal life outside it, because you never know when you're going to get the call to go and cover something. Things happen, stories break all the time. With court reporting, I would imagine it's quite similar, because cases can and trials can go on for so long. Can you plan a life outside of work? Can you go on a holiday? Can you do things like, well, obviously you can't at the moment, but can you do normal things, or is it always kind of, are you very committed to your work first?
I am. I think you have to be, you know, particularly when there's a big trial going on and the whole country is talking about it. It's very hard to switch off at all. Take Belfast, for example, and the reason I'm using that as an example is I'm sure you and your listeners are very familiar with it. And you know, I would spend a week in Belfast, completely immersed in the story and our coverage of it. And then when you go home at the weekends, it's all anybody wants to talk to you about. And everybody wants to know your opinion. Everybody wants to know what your thinking is. And again, I would never share those, because I think it's very dangerous for a court reporter to be talking about their opinions when a trial is live. It's very hard to switch off, but it's very important to switch off. I love what I do. I don't see it as a job in the traditional sense. I'm very rarely clock watching. I'm very rarely looking forward to getting out of the courtroom. I enjoy what I do, and I take it very seriously. And it is important to switch off, but sometimes it is very hard to, for that very reason, that, you know, when you're covering those high profile cases and you want to be covering those high profile cases, it's the reason that I do what I do. You do find that people are very interested in what you do, and people are very interested in talking about the cases. And, you know, there are so many barstool detectives out there. And I even remember after Belfast had wrapped up and after the four men that were on trial in relation to that case were acquitted of the charges, when I made it back to Dublin that evening after a very, very busy evening, as you can imagine, and I sat down in my local for a pint, and there were two guys sitting, you know, just over my shoulder talking in depth about the case. And it was a strange moment, because when you're in the middle of it, you do kind of tune out all of that stuff. But clearly, I do feel privileged to be at the coalface of these stories, to be covering these stories, to be, I hope, delivering it in a fair and accurate and also compassionate way. And compassion is also very important when you're covering these cases, because what people don't realize at home listening to the stories or reading the newspapers, newspaper reporting of these stories, is that they're just getting the tip of the iceberg. You know, you're sitting through hours and hours and hours of evidence, and you're having to choose what goes into a short court report or a newspaper report.
You might only have 30 seconds or so to tell the story.
Precisely. It's a very, very difficult skill. And particularly when you take into account that you have to give a balanced assessment of proceedings that day. You might sit through 4 hours of evidence and you're expected to sum up what you've heard in 40 seconds, or even, you know, over a longer interview, 5 minute interview, maybe. You know, it's very difficult to sum up absolutely everything that's happened. And you have to be fair to both sides when you're presenting the evidence of the day. And also you have to be mindful that the details, and we haven't gone into any great detail about what happened to Patricia O'Connor. It's all laid out in the book, but certainly even during the trial, I wouldn't have gone into any great detail about the grisly end that she met and the way that her body was disrespected by Kieran Green afterwards, because you do have to be conscious of taste and decency while still giving a true reflection of the day's proceedings. You know, I'm always conscious of kids in back of cars, for example, or if you're on in the morning, somebody, you know, making their cup of tea with the kids, getting ready for school. And I'm always conscious of those things. And, you know, the details are very harrowing and some people just don't want to hear them. And while it is important to get them across, you have to do it in a really tactful way. And that's a difficult skill, but but it's one that I'd like to think that over the years that I have got it right most of the time.
Yeah. Frank, just to kind of wrap up, has there ever been a worry about your safety when you're doing this job?
No, not personally, but I do know colleagues who have received threats down through the years. When I was a crime reporter in Dublin many years ago, certainly you would feel a little bit more vulnerable when you're out and about and on the beat and you're at crime scenes after a gangland shooting, for example. And, you know, there have been incidents where I certainly haven't felt welcome, you know, chased out of estates, and you might knock on the wrong door looking for perhaps somebody heard something, saw something, and you might knock on the wrong door. And certainly there have been hairy moments. And I know whenever there was when I was doing that job, and whenever there would be a shooting, a gangland shooting in Dublin, I know my mother all the way back in Galway would almost have the rosary beads out because she had this image of bullets flying and me cowering behind cars. And that's never the case. Usually when you get to a crime scene, clearly it's one of the safest places on earth because there's so many Gardaí there and whatnot. But certainly I've had a few hairy moments, but I know colleagues of mine who have received very serious threats, and it does give you pause for thought. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm just doing my job. It's an important job, I think, and I'll keep doing it as best I can.
Well, Frank Graney, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm delighted to see an old colleague of mine doing so well. Frank is a multi-award winning journalist. He's been honoured by the Law Society of Ireland on 3 occasions with Justice Media Awards, and I know that's going to continue. So good at his job. And Frank's book is out now, called Crowded House: The Definitive Story Behind the Gruesome Murder of Patricia O'Connor, and that's published by Gill Books. Frank, you're very good for taking our call today. Continued success in your career. You're doing so well, and hopefully we'll have you on again. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Trina.
This is Something for the Weekend. It's Classic Hits.